Why do we need a new theory of capital?
Again, the basic reason is that existing theories of capital do not do that well. First, the theories themselves, both the mainstream theories and the radical theories, I think are deeply problematic. And secondly, they are embedded in what, in our opinion, is an outdated cosmology. And these two difficulties have very significant historical consequences. Well, what do I mean by that? I think that those who wish to change the world need to consider the fact that so far, all of the significant challenges to capitalism, in fact, failed. So we know that communism failed around the world. We know that Keynesianism tried to alter fairly relatively secondary aspects of capitalism, and in fact, in doing so, it served to bolster it. And Keynesianism itself was abandoned since the 1970s and 1980s. The autonomous movement, if you go all the way back to the 19th century and end with the most spectacular movement of May 68, that attempt failed. And I think that the alter-globalization movement of the recent years is probably toying with a similar fate. And we need to ask ourselves, why have these revolutions failed? And of course, there are numerous explanations in attempt to explain those failures. But there is one reason that is very important and, in our view, hasn't been emphasized and often not noticed at all, is that those that have challenged capitalism in fact, fail to eliminate the inner core of that system. And what I mean by that is that they have adopted one of the central assumptions of capitalism. And by adopting that central assumption, they have let in a Trojan horse that eventually undermined their revolutions, whatever they were. What is this Trojan horse that I'm talking about? Well, you know, contenders and defenders of capitalism have very, very different worldviews. But it's interesting that on both sides there are two shared assumptions. And I'll try to briefly articulate them. The first assumption is a basic separation between politics and economics, or between the power sphere and the voluntary productive sphere. First is politics and the other is economics. From a liberal perspective, the basic sentiment is that politics serves to distort economics in inverted commas. It's some sort of a collective rape of the individualistic marketplace, if you wish. Politics is, to a great extent, a parasitic activity, in the sense that it uses utility that is produced by economics, but it's in itself does not produce any utility. Now, the Marxist view, of course, is very, very different. Here, politics is some sort of a superstructure that supports the material base of economics. The economy creates surplus, whereas the other spheres, particularly politics, through this superstructure, serve to shape and redistribute the surplus. Now, whatever the relationship, whether we take it from a liberal perspective or from a Marxist perspective, whether the relationship is thought of positively or dialectically, it is still a relationship between what seems to be two distinctly constituted entities. One is productive economics and the other is redistributive politics. So that's the first separation that, in our view, is common to both approaches to capitalism. The second separation that seems to be common is one that exists within the economy itself. And this separation is between the so-called real essence, namely production and consumption, that is understood in some material sense, and the nominal appearance of that essence that takes the form of prices, money, and finance. So this is the second separation common to both approaches. In this common framework, and again, the emphasis here is that this framework is common to both approaches, capital is understood as something that belongs to the real subset of the economy. Liberals talk about capital goods. Marxists talk about actual capital, and both of these serve to denote the so-called real capital. And this real capital gets reflected in the nominal appearances of money and prices, and it is certainly related to the broader sphere of politics. But all of these are external relationships. In other words, in this framework, capital is considered, when it is considered in and of itself, is an objective, productive entity. And that's it. Now, the reason I'm articulating these separations is that from this perspective of these two bifurcations or divisions, revolution becomes a purely political act. And why is that? Because the economy and the capital that is a subset of the economy are objective entities. And by definition, objective entities cannot be altered by human fancy. They can only be altered by science and technology. So the role of the revolution then becomes to first redirect the economy and capital and the capital stock so that they better serve the needs of the majority of the population. And the second role of the revolution is to transform politics so it better represents those needs of the majority. But the economy in general and capital in particular within this context of revolution remains largely uncontested because of these prior divisions. Now, in our view and in our publications and books, we argue that these dualities, which were first invented by the liberals and then accepted by the revolutionaries, these dualities are inherently false. What I mean is that when we come to discuss accumulation, there really is no separation between politics and economics, and there really is no bifurcation between the so-called real and nominal spheres. In our view, that there is really one single logic, and that's the logic of capital. And that logic is a logic of power. So for us, capital is not some sort of an objective, productive entity. Instead, it's an institution of power that is quantified as a financial entity. Now, if we disregard this power nature, in fact, we end up inviting this Trojan horse. If we disregard the fact that capital is a form of power and we treat it instead as if it were a real economic entity, in other words, something that can exist in communism, can exist in an anarchist society, and can and does exist in capitalism. So if we treat it as some sort of objective thing that exists in all of those things, we immediately infect our preferred alternative with the very logic that we wish to overthrow. So what ends up happening is that capitalist rituals start popping up in our language and our communication. The capitalist logic starts to affect our social organization. Economists, again, become objective, universal experts that we employ in order to give us solutions. And before long, this type of infection destroys our alternative society. I think it's quite obvious if one goes back and reads Gorbachev's book on Perestroika that was published in, I think, 1987, a couple of years before the Soviet Union collapsed, in that he uses all this jargon. He speaks about capital, he speaks about true value, he speaks in the language that is not very different from the language that capitalists used in capitalist countries. And he refers, though, to a communist society. So this is what I'm talking about when I'm referring to a Trojan horse that gets in through our misconception. So the conclusion, I think, from these considerations is that if we want to change capitalism, we first have to have a proper grasp of it. And in order to have a proper grasp of capitalism, of course, we have to have a proper grasp of the most important institution, the central institution of that order, and that is capital. if we do not have a good theory of capital, if the theory that we use is misleading, whatever structure we put to replace capital, even if that structure is morally compelling, it's bound to retain the logic of capital, and therefore at some point it will falter. So for this reason, it's not enough to have a theory of capital if the existing one is problematic. You need a new theory of capital if you are to change society. So that will be the end of the long answer.